In other news.
You know, the towers did not burn up. They turned into powder in midair.
That's scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
We walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. We continue to explore the realm of etheric energy. And in this show, we examine some of the incredible research by Dr. Paulo and Alexandra Correa, who through the years of self-funded research have repeated and improved upon experiments of Dr. Wilhelm Reich and Dr. Nikola Tesla, establishing the foundation-setting theory of mass-free energy. We focus specifically on the orgone motor and related physics and biophysics within the science of etherometry. The orgone motor is a self-running motor. It can be powered by a wired connection to two orgone accumulator boxes or our own insulated bodies or a ground pipe. Dr. Correa has successfully made an ether to mechanical conversion based on the work of Dr. Wilhelm Reich, who was known not to publish the design of the orgone energy motor. Dr. Eugene Maloff was a friend and supporter of Correa's etherometry work. Maloff said the oil companies aren't the major obstacle to the release of zero-point or vacuum energy into the public domain. The real interference is found within the United States government's academic community. We're joined by Dr. Paulo Correa, who is Research and Design Director of the Aurora Biophysics Research Institute, to talk about a range of topics, including his work in developing the orgone motor. He's a biophysicist, molecular biologist, hematologist, political scientist, author, and inventor. We go now to the first part of this interview with Dr. Paulo Correa. Dr. Paulo Correa, welcome to Another News.
Thank you.
Well, Dr. Correa, would you please give listeners some background about yourself and how you became involved in working with etheric energy and mass-free energy?
Well, it's a bit of a convoluted story. I originally came from a background in art rather than science. I was born in Portugal during a period where I grew up under a fascist regime or a crypto-fascist regime, and there was censorship and a great deal of discontent. This was sort of, an archaeological regime that had survived Second World War. It had its virtues. It kept Portugal out of the war. But as a young person, you always, at least in those days, we had a lot of thirst to understand the world around us. And the books of Wilhelm Reich and Sigmund Freud and others, they were all basically banned. And I remember being introduced to it by a friend that had found a Brazilian copy of Mass Psychology of Fascism, a very poor translation, but that was my first acquaintance of Wilhelm Reich. I think I was 16 or so. You know, I was very interested thereafter in mostly analytical and medical studies, including his period of being an Orthodox Freudian and then, to some extent, an Orthodox Marxist. I was never a Marxist. But Reich always fascinated me. He was capable of explaining things that are not so simple, in very simple terms, sometimes to the detriment of the thing itself. That was my first introduction. Then, during the course of so-called Portuguese Revolution, with which I was involved, I was a young man with idealist views of the world and very little experience of the world, obviously. I ended up basically as a political refugee in Canada. Shortly thereafter, I met Alexandra, the love of my life, if one can say so. And we've been together for nearly 46 years. And we pursued common interests. She was then graduating in psychology, and she had an interest in alternative psychiatry, in what was called at the time anti-psychiatry. And I also had an interest in that, especially since some of those people had followed the work of Reich, like Ardy Lang and Felix Guattari in France, Ardy Lang in UK, people that I came to meet later in my life. And so that was my original interest. It wasn't until much later when I completed my arts program where I met Alexandra, bilingual college here in Toronto, that I started to researching whether Reich's work in science, in biology, and in physics had any value. He made a lot of claims, most of which at that time could not be verified by anybody. And so I pursued some investigation. I was involved with my then professor, Edward Mann, who was creating an association of organomists up here in Canada with the help of Eva Reich, one of the daughters of Wilhelm Reich. And we got very involved in the launching of that organization up at York University. Me and Alexander were sort of the slaves of the operation. But in fact, we contributed a lot. Man could not have organized his first conference without us. There I came to know a lot of people in the field and realized slowly that there was very little research work done on investigating Reich's claims and even testing his methodologies. At that point, I felt that I really needed to go back to sciences. In Portugal, we had a regime that obliged you to choose when basically you were 14 years of age whether you wanted to go into the sciences stream or the arts stream. So I had to go back and, you know, pick math, physics, chemistry, biology. At that point, I became serious in pursuing, you know, basically a scientific education, which I did here at University of Toronto, and worked in the laboratory of Dr. Professor Arthur Axelrod. He became a professor emeritus later, basically the founder of the field of hematology. It was particularly erythropoiesis, red blood cell studies. It was from his lab that fundamental discovery of, for instance, the hormone erythropoietin came through in terms of understanding how red blood cells differentiate in marrow. And then we became very good friends. I did my master's and PhD in his laboratory. We became colleagues and we founded a company together, BioGrowth, that tried to exploit some of the inventions that we made, me and Arthur, which was basically, and still to this day, a serum-defined, serum-free medium, but chemically defined, that permitted us to actually chart the exact growth factors that targeted cells to develop along different lineages, whether it's red blood cell, white blood cell, or which type of lineage, let's say, within the white blood cells, because it's myeloid and lymphoid. You know, I did my biophysics and virology at that time, and then did molecular oncology and with him. At that time, Alexander and I bought a house, and in our basement, we basically created a plasma physics laboratory that we also intended, with some friends at the time, to serve as basically a place where we could test the bioelectric work of Wilhelm Reich and his claim to have discovered the life-specific energy that he termed orgon.
I read recently that in an autobiography of Dr. Reich, I read that he discovered the bions by looking at the deterioration of plant vegetation under a microscope.
Well, that was one of the avenues that he pursued. He also developed some protocols involving the incandescence of different materials, in particular sand, that led him to make the claim that we're looking at spontaneous generation of these bions, if you want to call them bacteria, and that's fine with me, since they can reproduce, they are undoubtedly on the bacterial realm, or properly speaking, the prokaryotic realm, cells without the nucleus. But his first observation was to the generation of grass blades and different tissues in situ. What he probably didn't realize at the time is that, and it was already known with the work of several people, both in plants as well as in human cells, that our cells contain bacteria-like, if you will, structures in plant chloroplastids, in human cells, mitochondria, I'm sure you've heard of them. And so when he was actually decomposing these cells were releasing these elements that are, if you will, semi-autonomous. Today we know far better than that. In fact, I have some papers that I have not published, but have been written now for God knows how long, but 10 or 11 years, where we formally demonstrate that in the case of a case that Reich often quoted, where he autoclaved red blood, blood cells, entire blood cells, full blood, and he observed the presence of these bions, these tiny little units of, 2 to 4 microns, under a powerful microscope that he had sought and bought and built to some extent. And in fact, what he was looking at, and we formally demonstrate that both with microscopy and with electron microscopy, that he was looking at mitochondria. In fact, some years ago, and I have not published this, we used the same serum-free medium that I was talking about a moment ago to test whether we could actually engage these protobacteria back into an autonomous existence, because they have been conditioned by symbiosis for, the evolutionary period of not just human beings, not just mammals, but mitochondria are present in all, eukaryotic complex organisms that have cells with nuclei. We call them eukaryotic cells. So, effectively, you can extract them from blood as well as you can extract them, let's say, from liver cells. And in the early 1920s, there were people actually extracting mitochondria from liver cells and trying to grow them in a separate culture medium, testing different media to see which medium would actually be the best. And they were using large quantities of serum in order to do so. I tried to do the same using the medium technique that Arthur and I invented, the serum-free defined medium, and was successful to a certain extent. I could keep cultures going for almost 3 months. So it's debatable where those cultures were growing or segmenting, because one thing we observed was these mitochondria typically sausage-like, and they would segment into little balls, much as if you're looking at, peas in a pod. But nevertheless, they were able to keep them going for a long, long time, and the conditions are chemically defined without serum. So Lynn Margulis, an American researcher, who was actually the biggest proponent of the series of mitochondrial symbiosis and how mitochondria came about, I think she anticipated that one day we might actually be able to find some of these elements that, once released from their symbiotic state, can regain their autonomy as, let's say, bacterial cells. So the story of the bion is a complex one, because Reich claimed spontaneous generation, but effectively that's not what he was observing, nor what he demonstrated. There's many reasons for that. There are technical reasons, including his high sterility experiments. They actually didn't reach a threshold that really permitted him to say that he had killed all spores, all germs, all possibilities of surviving bacterium. Today we know that that's not the case. The world of bacteria and the world of so-called cellular inclusions, that's the term, the technical term for such things as mitochondria or plastids. Today we know that that is not exactly plenty of bacteria that survive autoclaving or sterilization, liquid sterilization, using the techniques that Reich was using. So I'm not suggesting infection, not at all, but in order to prove the argument of spontaneous generation, one would have to do far more than what he did back in those days. And all the evidence that we have today suggests that, yes, you know, cells emerged in so-called biopoietic environments. We use the term biopoietic soup. And obviously, it will have been some kind of autonomous, spontaneous aggregation. There's work of Fox, Stanley Fox, with his micelles or protocells, that shows that it's possible, in fact, to think about small environments that sequester, you know, in essence, combinations of amino acids and nucleic acids, and permit them to enter into a relation similar to the relation that exists between, let's say, DNA and protein in our cells. But to produce life in a laboratory, the way Reich claimed, you know, he was in error. There's no doubt about that. It's a far more complex process than he took it to be.
That he made a mistake, he was still led on a certain path to learn more about ether energy through this mistake.
He might have claimed that to the extent that, for instance, he attributed... You see, Reich, let me backtrack a little. He made an important discovery while he was working still as a Freudian analyst and a medical doctor, which was that a great deal of the mental and social disturbances of our present-day society is caused by a condition that he termed sympathetic autonomia. Basically, it means our nervous system has a component that's autonomic. Our nervous system is complex. There's a central nervous system, and then there is the autonomic or vegetative nervous system. This is composed of two branches with horrible names. One is called the orthosympathetic, and the other is the parasympathetic. Well, the discovery that Reich made in his famous book about the function of the orgasm, he explains this in great detail, is that there's a whole set of so-called psychosomatic ailments that belong to the same dysfunction. And he referred to this dysfunction as sympathetic autonomia. That's also a huge big word. But in essence, what it means is that there is a growing reliance on the part of the organism on that subsystem of the nervous system, of the autonomic nervous system, on the powers of contraction and regulation. For instance, breathing in a sympathetic autonic situation tends to not present a full exhalation and retains dead air in the lung cavity. Heart rate in the case of hypertensive individuals is due to a sympathetic acceleration of the heart. So these two subsystems, they check one another out. The sympathetic system is responsible for the contraction of most organs, the viscera, their regulation in sense of responses like flight and fright. Conversely, the parasympathetic is responsible for the expansion of the viscera, for their tumescence, for their growth. Reich even referred to it as being the specifically productive phase of the life process. So his view was that a lot of disorders or ailments that are tied in to both neurotic and psychotic conditions have to do with this dysfunctional regulation of the autonomic nervous system. Now, this was a very important discovery. Later, he tacked on malignancy or cancer as one of the consequences. Now, that's perhaps too generic an ambition on his part, because there's a whole, you know, about 11 or 12% of all known cases of cancer in human beings, and that's some 117 different instances of cancer. Only about 11 or 12% are actually due to familial genetics, inheritable cancers, if you will. The other 80-something percent, they are actually acquired disorders. And what he was suggesting was that this latter, the larger number, was due to chronic stasis of sexual energy, and we're back to the big word, chronic sympathetic autonomia. So that was an important discovery. Later, he actually argued in the cancer biopathy that in individuals in advanced states of this disorder, that their cells could be observed to have a tendency to fall apart, decompose, hence the notion of the bions. They would decompose by releasing bions, and then he engaged in a very implausible demonstration that these bions would reorganize themselves to actually produce cancer cells. We know today that that's not at all the way malignancies progress. But that's not to say that, for instance, in the case of blood cells, individuals that have predisposition to leukemia or even to somatic cancers will not show, indeed, fragility of the cell and the tendency on the part of blood cells to actually fall apart, to decompose. The test that he created, which is a simple test in saline, can actually be used to time the speed of decomposition of blood cells. Not red blood cells, because red blood cells don't have any mitochondria and they don't have a nucleus. And so he was mistaken on some of those arguments. But certainly other blood cells, like myeloid blood cells or lymphoid blood cells, these are two different types of white blood cell, they do decompose that way. They show that in such a test, and in others, they can be shown to actually be cells that don't have, let's say, a normal endurance. So there's a lot of good stuff in his work. You also have to place it in years. I mean, back in the 1930s, that's when the great Albert Leninger was first studying with electron microscopy and biochemical methods the mitochondrion, or mitochondria, if you will. So one has to make some evaluation of Reich's work in the context, the epochal context in which it occurred. Otherwise, it doesn't make any sense. But that he made inferences that were not valid, yes, he made plenty of those.
I think that's the way it goes for a lot of scientists and researchers and inventors. They do make mistakes, but those mistakes sometimes lead to great understandings.
Well, as I was saying to you, Alexander and I, we created a laboratory in our basement back in those early 80s, and we started to test some of Reich's work in biophysics, starting with his work with electroscopes, the organ accumulator, as he called it. And later on, this led to all sorts of, you know, studies of the pendulum that he claimed, both the gravitational pendulum that he claimed to have discovered that had a particular constant when situated on the surface of the Earth at particular latitude, and the electrical pendulum, because he also did studies with the electrical pendulum. So we did a lot of this work, but at the same time that we're doing it, we're also interested in reproducing some of his studies that he called the studies with vacuum tubes that were evacuated to very high negative pressures. In that process, we decided to actually teach ourselves a little about vacuum regimes, or so-called volt-ampere response of vacuum discharges. Reich is not the creator of that field. On the contrary, that field started a long time ago with Gauss and others in the middle of the 19th century, Faraday and so on. By the time that we were doing this investigation, a full volt-ampere curve had actually been created for all sorts of electrical discharge regimes, including plasma regimes. What we discovered while we were doing this work was that somewhere at the junction between what's called the abnormal glow discharge, that's a term that's applied to a discharge that has a saturating current applied to the cathode, and vacuum arc discharge, sometimes referred to as VAD, vacuum arc discharge, there was a spontaneous discharge small glow discharge. Now, and which we eventually, as we discovered that nobody else had charted it or reported it, we actually filed for 3 patents on design of the reactor, on the production of phenomenon, on its utilization for different purposes, including driving motors or as an inverter from DC to AC, and so on. Now, at the time that we made this discovery, which was 1986, General Electric had just closed their major laboratory in plasma physics and vacuum arc discharges. And they had published a book. There was sort of the closing book, a very interesting book, where all researchers contributed their views, including the possibility that vacuum arc discharges could be used to tap the so-called vacuum state and extract energy in excess of break-even from that state. Now, the GE people never demonstrated this was, you know, largely based on mathematical considerations from experimental work that they had been conducting for over 10 years. And we realized that, you know, our discovery was right there at that cusp. So at that point, you know, much of the interest that we had in Reich abated a bit, because now we were onto something that was actually well studied in accepted physics. We developed the system to the point that we were convinced that we were indeed extracting, through this spontaneous pulsation, energy from the vacuum. Incidentally, late 1950s and early 1960s, both in the United States, for purposes of use in controlling nuclear reactors, and in Soviet Union at the time, researchers were also looking at, I think, the same phenomenon under the term spontaneous autoelectronic cathode emissions. Because, in fact, what drives this abnormal glow discharge that's pulsed, what makes it pulse, is the emission of electrons, spontaneous emission of electrons from cathodes. They have a low work function. So this has been a field that many laboratories, physics laboratories, back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, were actually looking into without, I think, any of them having a breakthrough the way we did. So we filed for 3 patents at the time. We got them. We actually proved that it was possible to provide a patent that described a machine which effectively, we claimed, was generating, was releasing more energy than it was consuming. So that is a whole story of so-called PEGD converter. But during that period of time, we're also doing the systematic reproductions of Reich's work. And what we found is that there is no such thing per se as orgone in the sense that Reich was talking about. There is no life-specific energy. The energy of the cosmos, or the energy that, or the energies that human beings or any living systems utilize, they are in a continuum. He was right in thinking that there is mass-free energy, and this is, you know, undoubtedly his most important discovery. Terming it orgone, as you know, later on you were sorry about that because there was also discovery of the deadly orgone. So what was all that about? Well, it took Alexander and I a few more years before we could actually figure out exactly what is mass-free energy. Today, as you probably have noticed by perusing our website, we've actually published the spectrum of mass-free energy, and that led us to many other inroads into physics, including a publication in 2011 of the actual fine structure, the topological geometry of an electron, which to this day physics refuses to consider it as an object that is spatial. Well, we showed that it's a very elastic object, but it has definite boundaries and definite conditions, and there's definite structures and geometry. But backtracking to what really, at the end of the day, is the nature of mass-free energy, we designate it as ambipolar energy. Why? For two reasons. First of all, Reich wasn't able to show that is orgone energy.
You designated antipole energy? Is that what it was?
Antipolar.
Antipolar. That means there's no magnetic charge?
Magnetism is not about charge. There is, in fact, no such thing as magnetic charge. Electric charge carries a magnetic wave. And that magnetic wave, basically pins any mass-bound charge, such as an electron or a positron, to have a particular direction of its spin with respect to forward motion. If you can picture that, picture a disk, if you will. I'm trying to simplify this. And picture the rotation, the direction of rotation of the disk, which is arbitrary in space, but picture it as being non-arbitrary with respect to forward motion. So, for instance, to simplify, an electron and a positron, they are sort of proto-atoms of matter, the very first atoms, and they constantly turn by virtue of their magnetic wave. But an electron, with respect to direction of forward motion, will turn counterclockwise, and the positron will turn clockwise. That spin is what allows us to detect the charge of the electron or the negatron as being a negative charge, and in the case of the positron, as being a positive charge. And likewise for the proton and the antiproton and so on. These being four basic mass-bound charges. In the case of ambipolar charges, in the same way, there is a magnetic wave to the ambipolar charge. We call it the ambipolon, P-L-O-N. But this magnetic wave changes, if you will, its phase over 180 degrees. So the structure, the geometry, is totally different. If the electron or the positron is a torus, and that's what we published in 2011, was the structure of the electron, the negatron, if you will, which is the same structure as positron, just with reverse spins. In the case of the ambipolon, you have to think of it more like a traveling tube, a traveling flux tube. And so, phenomenologically, in terms of manifestation, it appears to have no charge, to be electrically neutral. In fact, it's not. It carries exactly the same charge momentum or the same electrical property as you'll find in an electron or a proton and so on, except that this charge is not bound to have just a one valence in terms of polarity. It constantly alternates its polarity. And this alternation is intrinsic to the structure of charge. You see, we have an alternation in voltage when we talk about alternate current, but that affects only the electric wave of, let's say, an energy element. In the case of the ambipolon, the alternation is the alternation that's built in directly into the magnetic wave of the ambipolon. So there's no way we can confuse ambipolar radiation or ambipolar energy with, let's say, alternate currents of electrons oscillating in a conductor or any other form of, you know, alternate current. It doesn't have to be sinusoidal. Even topogeometrical structures for the energy, mass-free energy carries an electric charge, but the charge is, if you will, obfuscated, obnubilated. You know, it's not, phenomenologically appears not to be there, but in fact it is. Now, more recently, in this past 10 years, we've actually came to demonstrate that photons don't travel very far. I mean, you have to get to the world of radiological photons, X-rays and gamma rays, before a photon winds a sufficiently large trajectory in space. But if we're talking about photons, like infrared photons, they are basically they are born and die on the same spot. The length they travel, each photon is no more than an atometer. That's a ridiculously small quantity. So what is it that transmits the electromagnetic signal, if you will, is basically the ambipolon. It transmits not just electromagnetic signals, it transmits also all electric signals, whether they are AC or DC. So that discovery, which is detailed in great detail in the latest book that we released just this year, is part and parcel of our work in human bioenergetics and our claim to have identified actually for the first time the actual structure of the living bioplasma. And this bioplasma is made up of electron dyads, and I mean negatron dyads, because we have identified the weak attraction between negatrons and allows them to create sort of this bilaminar structure, this dual structure, that permits it to flow on all biological surfaces. They also exist in the ground, and you can transmit them across water. We showed all these experiments in this book. But most importantly, we identify in this book that all, not just human body or living systems, but for instance, when we talk about household currents transmitting AC signals at a distance, you know, the 60 hertz signal or 50 hertz signal. Well, what carries that signal is not a 60 hertz or 50 hertz photon. It's actually an ambipolon with the different characteristics of the emitter at the four different voltages. And we showed this with a machine that we invented, Alexander and I, in this past. Well, we've been working on this for a good 21 years. It's called the bioelectric meter. It permits you to detect electricity both at a distance and in contact. And we showed, we demonstrated with this machine, that what propagates from, let's say, power lines or household lines is the ambipolons that carry the signal, not any photons. Likewise, we demonstrated that for AC signals and DC signals. And we provided actually all of the mathematical basis for the experiments on this book. So effectively, ambipolons, they are the conveyors of electromagnetic and electric signals. And let's backtrack now to the argon. So if mass-free energy is electric energy that has electric properties, but its charge, it's obscured, its charge is, it appears to not be actually polarized when it is, how do we detect it? We detect it because, in effect, all mass-bound charges capture it. In fact, an electrical field in physics, we think about an electrical field as conveying some voltage that propagates across space, across a distance. But it's a disembodied field, you know. Voltage is just a term for an electric wave. Where is the rest? You know, energy doesn't travel as disembodied waves, even though our physics, including the treatment of Cherenkov radiation, treats it as if it's possible to deal with the wave envelope as something that is separable or separated from the transmission of energy at a distance. And that is not the case. What travels is always a flux of energy. You know, there are no disembodied waves. Voltage itself as a form cannot travel by itself. It has to rely on some flow of energy. So we're talking about understanding how the mass-free world composes and interacts with, let's say, the world of matter or the world of mass-bound charges and mass-bound constructs. So it's there that the question of orgon and dorgon, or so-called dor, enter. Why? Because up until a certain cutoff point, this ambipolar energy, and I'll tell you the cutoff point, we published this in 2003 or 4, I forget now, is about 79 kiloelectron volts. Up until 79 kiloelectron volts, we're dealing with electric ambipolar radiation that is actually beneficial to living systems and can be easily captured by living systems. In this latest book we just published, we actually show that inside of the pineal body, we refer to work that we published earlier, where the pineal body serves as a comparator between, let's say, ambipolar energy that's outside of the body and bipolar and ambipolar energy that circulates in the blood.
That's fascinating.
So there, we have organs that compare, and it's not just photic stimuli. These are secondary consequences of the electric flow. The electromagnetics are always secondary in this case. But, you know, the reason why we have an eye that has receded far inside of the brain in contact with, you know, the primitive brain is precisely because it's not measuring photic stimuli, but aphotic signals, ambipolar signals. So, and we show, for instance, in this book that, again, this goes back to one of the mistakes that Reich did. We don't have just one source or center of bioelectricity in the body. We have three. We have the brain center, the diencephalon. We have the heart at level of the nodes, the AV and SA nodes. And we have also the sacral cord in the pelvic region. So we actually have a conjugation of three different bioelectric centers. And each of these centers generates, of course, a flux of bioplasma, but mobilizes that bioplasma by generating, above all, an emission of ambipolar radiation. And so the entire body is internally bathed by ambipolar radiation. We believe its clock function, which we have called the ambipolar master clock, is a chronometer that works on the one-second basis, very close to the solar second. But we also, from studies using our apparatus, we can show that indeed, and neurobiology has confirmed the same, that these pulsed oscillations don't go past some 90 to perhaps 100 per second. So it's a discrete realm of ambipolar oscillations that's driving most of the neural bioplasma, that means bioplasma that circulates in the nervous system through all of the neurons. And of course, what I'm saying is that the source of this bioplasma is not just neuronal. It is neuronal for the diencephalon in the brain. It is neuronal for the sacral cord. But in the case of the pacemaker cells of the cardiac system, it's obviously of a mesodermal origin, so it's muscle cells. All of this, to get back to what I was trying to say, that already in the case of the solar electric radiation, we have we identified its spectrum, and we published that in 2003, the spectrum of ambipolar electric radiation from the sun. And we can see that the mode, the major mode that's responsible for the production of blue light, the azure that we see in the sky, is the blue light from the sun, here diffused in the atmosphere. But its main mode is at 51 kilo electron volts. So well within so-called argon spectrum. That spectrum has a cutoff at about 79 kiloelectron volts, and above, from 79 to 511 kiloelectron volts, we are technically talking about ambipolar radiation that's noxious to the living. And therefore, you know, you can call it argon, if you will. But you see, the terms, why did we keep those terms? Because Reich really was onto something similar to what biologists were in the 60s when, you know, radiobiology and photobiology separated. When that happened in the late 50s, early 60s, we suddenly realized that there was a domain of electromagnetism that was, let's say, beneficial to life, spanning photons from the ultraviolet, let's say, down to the infrared. And then at some cutoff point, which photobiology has correctly put at about 300 nanometers wavelength, we had instead a domain of electromagnetic photons, electromagnetic in situ radiation, local radiation, that was actually noxious for living cells, but in accordance with several experiments from the 50s, was implicated in biogenesis, in the genesis precisely of life, in the sense that this realm of, you know, I'm talking about basically UVB and UVC. So anywhere between 300 nanometers to about 60 nanometers, it's a whole realm of ultraviolet light that is important for the genesis of life, evolutionarily speaking, but is radiation that's noxious because it generates free radicals. And other than for very few free radicals, living systems don't, in particularly mammals, don't like free radicals. They attack the lungs, they attack the eyes, and so on, particularly those that are free radicals of nitrogen and oxygen. So that is a whole realm still of photobiology. And then there's a cutoff point somewhere around 57 nanometers, and above that, the photons that can be produced, they are all radio photons or gamma photons, and that's definitely noxious to life. As you know, today we know very well that exposure to gamma radiation and to repeated X radiation can induce all sorts of somatics and blood cancers. So in the same way there is this cutoff in photobiology, speaking now the term photobiology in the widest sense, because it includes radiobiology in this sense now. Likewise, in the world of ambipolar radiation, which generates most of these photons, I mean, not necessarily radiological photons, but all non-ionizing photons, they are byproducts of the interaction of ambipolar energy with mass-bound charges, every one of them. So in the same way that we can make those distinctions in the electromagnetic spectrum, we can also make similar distinctions in the ambipolar spectrum. And up until, as I said, 79 kiloelectron volts, we're looking at beneficial ambipolar radiation, or if you will, Tesla radiation. Above that, we are looking at radiation that is detrimental to every living system that we know on Earth. So it's justifiable to describe mass-free ambipolar energy within the 79 kiloelectron volt bracket as orgone, and to describe that other bracket that goes from 79 to about 511 kiloelectron volts as being DOR. In trying to safeguard these discoveries, he engaged in a certain myth-making, you know, including a certain complex of saving the world. I mean, I think the world at this point has had enough of saviors, you know. I take a very different view of this than he did. I mean, with the notion the murder of Christ is the murder of all life. Well, undoubtedly, the murder of Jesus is not separable from the murder that human beings have been committing, God knows for how long, on one another and on nature and their environment.
I want to thank you for going into very technical detail that I'm going to have to listen back to again to fully grasp, because that's the first time I've heard this explanation of orgone energy in these terms. I didn't realize the orgone generator was using energy from an orgone accumulator. I know it has other sources.
This all goes back to Nikola Tesla's dream of plugging our electrical machinery into the real works of nature, as he used to say. And as you know, he actually was the inventor of the induction motor. Well, okay, Ferrari also at the same time in Italy, but we owe today almost the entirety of our basic electrical infrastructure, from AC to Niagara Falls, to Nikola Tesla. Now, he actually was the first fellow to come up with the principles of the so-called orgone motor. And, you know, it begins, of course, with getting understanding how to create a motor with the right stator and the right rotor that permits it to develop a continuous motor action using, let's say, an AC signal or a pulsed signal, which are different things. But it all goes back to him. And then what did he do? I mean, there's a lecture that he gave in 1893, if I recall properly, at the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia, and also some pictures that he showed in his lecture about increasing the problem of increasing human energy much later. They refer to the same experiment. What he did do was he used a Tesla coil. That's a form of, if you will, induction coil, where the primary and secondary operate by the proportionality of their capacitances, not necessarily by the proportionality of their inductances. And he built in a field a variety of, you know, capture circuits. They were resonant. In this case, you know, the coils were identical to the emitting secondary. And he was able to capture in any place in this field significant currents that, you know, he described as being currents that were up there on the 90%, 95% of the emitting current. Probably that only applies if it's a single receiver. In his field where he had several, I'm pretty sure that that wouldn't apply to all of them. But his view was not so much that he was extracting energy from the vacuum state. It was that, I think in one of those lectures, he mentions how in the future, when the planet will be deforested and there'll be no more coal to burn and so on, that all we'll be left with is the transmission of power. That's what he was actually after. And it was the discovery of the actual radio transmission. It was not Marconi. That's one of the great injustices of the U.S. patenting system that denied this patent. Finally, you know, some, what, now 15 years ago, they put it back, you know, so posthumously that it's a joke, that indeed they recognized that Nikola Tesla was the one who actually should have received the patent for the propagation of radio signals. But what was the fundamental difference? And Tesla pointed this out many times, was that whereas Marconi and others were only looking at transmission across the atmosphere, what Tesla unfortunately called electromagnetic transmission, he was actually looking at transmission through ground currents. These were longitudinal currents, led him to argue that actually the ether was electric and propagated through longitudinal waves. By the way, that's ambipolar energy right there, because ambipolar waves are indeed, they propagate longitudinally, not transversely, like electromagnetic waves, so to speak. And so his discovery was to optimize the transmission of power using resonant circuits and utilizing ground currents. That doesn't mean that, you know, the system could also not pick up the 10% that travels or so through the atmospheric medium, but the important thing was to be able to pick up the ground currents. That's actually the beginning of, if you will, the ether motor. Later, he actually got patents where, through precisely the system of transmission, and patent actually describes it as a power transmission system, he could operate all sorts of devices, electrical devices, including a motor. And as it turns out, the motors that Wilhelm Reich used, which were produced by the Bell laboratories, they were so-called KS motors, spinner motors. They were actually created for an electro-analog computer. In those days, people used to call them predictors, predictors of elevation, azimuth, altitude, and they were used basically as gun directors. This was very important during the Second World War, when, you know, basically computing took over all operations of firing artillery and firing rockets, obviously. And so these spinners, they were developed. Essentially, the spinner is what's called in engineering a drag cup motor. It's a special kind of induction motor where there is proportionality between the RPM and the voltage that is imparted to the two-phase starter. and it permits you to have very fast computations. You probably have heard about the Turing machine and about Turing himself and how he collaborated during the Second World War in the project that the British intelligence called MKUltra carried on to break German codes, particularly naval codes, of the so-called Enigma machine. Well, Turing, in the British establishment at, I forget now the name of the building, famous establishment of the British Security Service, he actually, his machine is made up of these very fast-turning electro-analog spinner motors. In this case, they were slotted motors, but you see, this is the beginning of computers, actually. These are electro-analog computers. And the spinners were used both in the control of missiles. There was a project in the United States that was super secret at the time of Reich's work with these spinner motors. In fact, he got these motors sort of on the sly. I won't say illegally, but they were on the sly because they were not at the time available to the civilian population. There was a project called the Nike missile project. These motors, including some further alterations of them that used magnetically coupled flywheels, they were used in the flight control of these missiles. Now, these motors go back, as I'm saying, they're drag cup induction motors, and they were invented by Tesla. And in fact, in one of Tesla's transmission of power patents, he has one such induction motor as an example of an application. So that's actually something I've always struggled with a bit. Why didn't Reich give Tesla the due credit?
That's going to do it for the first part of this interview with Dr. Paulo Correa. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guests.